Hey everybody, this is just a quick reminder that your Hugo nominations are due tomorrow, March 10th at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now for those of you that are not in the United States, that time may be a little bit different than it normally is because we've already had daylight savings time, and if I recall correctly, some parts of the world have not already had it. So do make sure to double check because the hour difference may be slightly different, maybe an hour off, essentially. So otherwise, I really hope that you have really cool stuff on your ballots and get those in ASAP because every vote counts no matter what it's for. So I'll be turning in mine pretty soon. So on that note, I really hope you enjoy this sort of impromptu episode, and thank you for listening.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show.
He lived long and prospered.
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike. And I'm Paul.
And we're here with a kind of a special episode to talk about the sort of the legacy of Leonard Nimoy. I guess that would be the best way to describe what we're going to talk about. Since he passed away last week, somewhat suddenly. And yeah, it's been kind of a roller coaster of very emotional responses to Nimoy. I mean, Twitter was exploding with just people sharing all kinds of links and you know, inspirational things that Nimoy had done. There was the interesting thing that went around of his very long response to a mixed race fan, which I thought was really interesting. I don't know if anybody saw that. So we're here to talk about that, and I think the best place for us to probably start then would be to talk about kind of how Nimoy fits into our own life, as it were, however much he might. And so I guess I'll just start with you, Mike, kind of get us off on the roll.
Sure. I never really watched original series much, but I did grow up on Next Generation, and Nimoy had a few guest star spots. And even at that point, I knew, oh, he's from the original continuity. And so there was a sense of history from the character. And so Next Generation was important to me, and then I watched Voyager and Deep Space Nine, and then kind of he came back into my kind of sphere of fandom in Fringe, where he played William Bell, the counterpart to one of the leads, and just the gravitas that he brought to that role and the fun meta aspect to having him in another science fiction property was really powerful. And when he passed, it hit me a lot harder than I was expecting, given how little compared to, I think, a lot of other people of his material that I've seen. But what I think really got to me was knowing how much that he had meant to so many people, and for it to be a shared grieving process that happened in real time, and that I had the opportunity to be there as people were processing their feelings, and that it seemed like they were so universally positive. Sometimes when we have celebrities pass, the kind of the negative bubbles up with the positive. But this time I saw really only positive. And I was particularly struck by the series of selfies that people took making the live long and prosper gesture. The first person I saw do that was Javier Grillo Markswatch, who's the creator of The Middleman. And then just by that evening, it was everywhere. Everyone was doing it. And I couldn't think of a better memorial other than to kind of live a life in a Roddenberryan ideal and to be the polymath that he was.
Yeah, I missed the people taking selfies, but I remember turning on my Twitter that morning and just seeing everybody talking about, like, any little thing that they could remember. People who had personal stories and people who had just things that they found inspirational about his characters or his life. It was a big thing. It was very, I felt like a kind of an analog was, you know, when Michael Jackson died, and with the exception being that there probably isn't going to be like a primetime TV funeral, because I don't know how you would do that anyway for a Star Trek character. But I imagine that there are probably going to be people, you know, doing, rewatch sessions of like classic Star Trek or the movies, mm-hmm. As I've been doing, and I'm sure you guys have been doing as well. So Paul, why don't we jump to you and have you kind of jump in? You might have a very different perspective, I think.
I'm a little older than the both of you. So,
and not by that much.
I also had a strange upbringing as far as I didn't see movies in a movie theater until I was about 13. So I was of an age where I saw the original episode in syndication. So I saw Leonard Nimoy as relatively young. As Spock, and it's like, hey, Spock is great. I love Spock. I mean, Captain Kirk and McCoy could go hang. I loved Spock. And I remember this was like in the early, like 1983. Now, I had not seen a movie in a movie theater, which means, yes, I didn't get to see Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back or Star Trek 1 in the movie theater, or as it so happens, I didn't see Star Trek 2 in a movie theater, but I saw an issue of Starlog. And the issue of Starlog, it came out a couple months after Wrath of Khan talked about Spock's death and how could we get him back? And I thought, what? They killed Spock? I was kind of like, how could you do that? So the first Star Trek movie I actually saw in a theater was Star Trek III, which I thought was wonderful because it gave me Spock back. In high school, everyone thought I was the Vulcan because I was intelligent. I mean, this was before Next Generation. I mean, a few years later, they probably would associate me with Data, but no, since everyone knew the original series, they associated me with Spock, and I accepted that and I embraced that. And I mean, Nimoy was much more than Spock. I mean, every time I come across him in other media, I would get a buzz. We can talk about some of those in more detail, but one I just want to mention right now is the Civilization games, games. The Civilization 4. He was the voice of the technology. When you get a new technology, he would read off the little quote that ties into that technology. I thought that was a great choice. Oh yeah, I forgot. In Search Up, I mean, In Search Up was in syndication when I was young too, so I saw all of those too. I thought that was neat.
That's fun. That's really fun, Paul. So your first Star Trek movie was Star Trek
3? In a theater was 3, yes.
Oh. That's an interesting one to start with. In a theater, at least, yeah.
Well, yeah, I'd seen one on TV, a cut version. I didn't see 2 until I hit TV, but it was after that Starlog got issue, so I was already spoiled. I knew he was going to die. And it's like, wait, what? I got spoiled by a magazine.
Was this far enough back in the past when VHS didn't exist?
There wasn't much VHS, no.
Okay. Because I think I was the fortune. Maybe Mike and I probably are pretty close in that respect. We probably grew up right around when VHS became like a normal thing, and then you had, you know, VHS rental stores actually start showing up. So it's very interesting to think about the generational difference, even something as small as, I mean, because Paul, you're not that much older than us, a little bit, but not terribly much older.
I was born in 71.
Not that much older. I mean,
Depends on how you slice generations. But I'm sure that people have written about how fandom changed, media fandom specifically, as you moved from you have to watch it when it's on to you can have VHS recordings and kind of fan swapping of recordings. I imagine that the manner in which fandom was performed is different and kind of changes people's reaction, relationships to things. But, you know, by the 70s there, you know, we already had a very strong fanzine culture. So there was a lot of that fandom going on, to my knowledge, kind of during that first Trek run.
Yeah. So I guess my perspective will be a little bit different because I was born in 83. And, you know, I'm a little old now, but not as old as some people. So I didn't grow up on Star Trek. I was too young, really, to be into Next Generation. I mean, I've seen Next Generation, and I got into it when I got older. But I didn't really get into Star Trek until probably the mid-90s. In general, like in a kind of an interest in the whole field. That said, my first Star Trek film was actually for, this is The Voyage Home. I can't remember. Yeah. That's actually that's my first Star Trek film. And that's, I blame that entirely on my grandmother, because my grandma had this knack for picking really good science fiction movies that she really liked, and then having me watch them. So I watched films like Enemy Mine, which I think is deeply underrated, and I probably have seen the fourth Star Trek film, I mean, maybe 50, 60 times in my life, because it would be on, we would turn it on when I was there, because it had spaceships and whales, and I liked whales, so, you know, singing whales. So I wouldn't say that I was a Trekkie when I was a kid, a little bit more of it now, but it's obviously that one film has had some impact on me in terms of my interest in science fiction stuff. And, you know, going back as a much older person and watching some of the original Star Trek, and watching all of the films again, and even reading some of the stuff he wrote. I mean, last year I read his book, I Am Spock, which is really, really good. He talks about his whole career, and, his career was, you know, a very fascinating career. I mean, he went from, you know, being the kind of one caricature to sort of becoming another, and then kind of having his own tumultuous journey, discovering, you know, how much he identified with his Spock character, even though it kind of became a thing that he never really escaped from, and kind of embracing it, in fact, rather than kind of rejecting it, as some people have done with their characters they become known for. So, in that respect, it's, you know, that kind of an influence in terms of my science fiction watching. But of course, you know, if you grew up, you know, if you're born in 83 and you grew up basically between that period, the Spock's influence, I mean, in ways you couldn't even imagine. I mean, I was doing the Vulcan sign even before I understood fully what that meant. Which is weird when you think about it. Like, I'm just like, live long and prosper, and like trying to make my fingers do the thing, and not really understanding what the hell I'm doing. Then, you know, finally you do understand when you really fully get through it. Because, like, let's be honest, when I was, like, six and watching, you know, the fourth Star Trek movie, like, I really understood what was going on. All I knew was creepy cylinder in space and singing whales. Right? And for some reason, they were doing the Superman with the Klingon warbird. Right? Going really, really fast.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, so, you know, I wouldn't say I had quite the experience that a lot of people who sort of grew up in that era and were deeply influenced by Star Trek. I didn't have quite that experience. However, like you, Mike, it was kind of surprising how much his passing kind of affected me, because he just seemed like one of those figures who's just going to live forever, which is weird because you know that he can't, but you just kind of like, Leonard Nimoy and Spock, they're just going to be here forever. You know? Timeless. Yeah. He's a timeless figure.
Yeah, and his, you know, his career spanned more than 60 years as an actor and then later director and writer. So his kind of his career and media science fiction have more overlap than not in terms of time, if we're talking about kind of general Hollywood, the general Hollywood paradigm. So to have such a career casts quite a lot, quite a shadow of influence across the history of the genre.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting when Zachary Quinto was talking in an interview. He was asked about his relationship with Leonard Nimoy and how touching it was for him to talk about how, you know, he thought of him as, you know, he's just this guy I'm going to talk to about his character to kind of really get into the process of playing this iconic role, which, I mean, for any actor would be kind of terrifying, I imagine. And then sort of becoming friends and then seeing him as a father figure, which yeah. I thought was just really, you know, it says a lot, I think, about, you know, there's something about Leonard Nimoy, based on what I know from having read his book, that he's kind of, he's that figure he just seems like he's just a great person. And in any context, you know, not a perfect person, but just like he was a great human being. I mean, I can't think of anything negative that people could have said about him, I mean, other than maybe like they didn't like some of his directing work. But I mean, but his character, I mean, I think that's the most interesting thing, is looking at his character as a person and how that has had an impact on people. Impact will be far greater, I think, than his role itself. Because Spock, of course, is significant, and even some of his other roles are significant as well. But I think the personal impact he had on people, particularly those that he knew personally or at least met, I think that's what's going to live on in a way that his character can't.
Yeah, and since his passing, several accounts have come up, and I think these may have all been confirmed before, but were kind of made more publicly known, that during the run of the original TV show, that he and other cast members, but perhaps him as the leader, went in to advocate for Walter Koenig and Michelle Nichols to be given equal pay to the other leads. And that when the animated series was being produced, they were originally not going to bring on Nichelle Nichols or George Takei to do voice acting. And Nimoy went to them and said, I will not be in this unless you hire both of them. So it does seem that within the Star Trek world, and probably without it, he was a strong advocate for his colleagues and for equality and kind of walking the walk of the diversity that the original Star Trek was very specifically designed to embody.
Yeah, I heard those stories too, and it just doesn't surprise me that he would have done that.
No, it really wouldn't. I mean, if people have not read the book I Am Spock, I really do recommend it. It's really, really interesting. It's kind of like a memoir of his becoming an actor and eventually developing the character of Spock. But that's the kind of behavior he took throughout. I mean, not only in kind of the social justice side, you know, kind of making sure people are treated fairly, but even in terms of protecting the character, the sanctity of the character, you know, he worked really hard to sort of develop Spock in a way that seemed appropriate for the character, and then to protect that character from becoming kind of a cog in a kind of Hollywood wheel, mm-hmm. Which I thought was really interesting in terms of, because you don't really hear about that. I mean, you just kind of hear like, oh, we're just going to like reboot the character and you just like, you know, have him do whatever, and we don't have to pay attention to how this character has become who he is. We can just kind of discard all of that because it's convenient. But it's like, no, the story has to resolve around the limitations that the character presents. And that's a character that he very much embodied, or at least came to embody as he grew up. So, or not grew up, sorry. He was grown up when he started Star Trek. I mean, when he, as he grew older and became more wizened, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, those kinds of stories I mentioned at the beginning, but when I never actually read the account of him talking about the connection between Spock and prejudice, and when he's talking to this young mixed race kid, and that whole account, I'd never read it before, and when I finally read this thing, it was really quite moving, because he's right. Everything he's saying there is really quite, I think, you know, given the period at which we're talking, I mean, we think on some level that period is, you know, it's disgustingly more sexist and disgustingly more racist than we think of today, right? We think that we've progressed so much, but yet when you hear about the kinds of the way in which some people behaved, particularly within the Star Trek world, behave towards other people and treat other people and think, there is something about that I think goes to the heart of what the Star Trek franchise was always about, and what the Spock character was one particularly poignant piece to. So,
Yeah. And it's been interesting for me to see just how much of his Judaism Nimoy brought to the Spock character. There was a cool interview that was excerpted from a Hebrew language oral history project where he relates the story of a moment in his youth at Temple that gave him the symbol that would become the gesture for live long and prosper.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'll go back and find that so we can put it in the show notes, because I think it's a great bit of Trek trivia, but also a good bit of religion and science fiction trivia.
Yeah. I remember hearing about that. It's a very interesting piece of trivia. But for the character as well, I mean, I suspect in many ways there are very interesting intersections between his own personal faith and his very, very hands-on involvement in the development of Spock. I mean, he was Spock. He built Spock. If you read his book.
He lived Spock, yeah.
Yeah, he literally built this character. I mean, there was like a template they set up. But when you read his how he talked about developing Spock, I mean, it was really Leonard Nimoy's character. I mean, there's a point at which they hit the line at where they could not replace him. And there was no possible way they could ever put somebody else in this role because he was Spock.
Right. And I've seen people discussing the fact that kind of for them, Nimoy's Spock was the first human alien in science fiction media for them.
Oh, yeah.
Not necessarily that he was like the first alien character that was humanized or dramatized in a relatable way, but that because it was so popular, a lesser actor or an actor that didn't take the initiative or didn't have better direction or better writing might never have created that landmark character.
Yeah.
Because I think it would be very difficult to overestimate the influence that the character of Spock has had on other media depictions of aliens.
That's true, yeah. I mean, that the Star Trek franchise as a whole, and particularly Spock, I mean, it seems to have ushered in a period of you know, the kind of humanoid alien analog. There's a name for the sort of the flawed biology of Star Trek. The idea
you talk about rubber-headed aliens.
No. The idea that the universe is populated by all of these very human-like species with very very slight alterations, but yet for some strange reason they can all interbreed.
Well, they actually explain that in the Next Generation episode.
I know, but let's be honest. It's probably not biologically accurate.
It's techno-biobabble, but at least they realized it was a problem and actually decided to solve why in the world Vulcans and humans could have children together.
Hey, you know, when you mix green blood with red blood,
you get mucky blood.
I guess, although his blood is... He's half and half, and yet he is still green-blooded. So clearly the Vulcan phenotype is the dominant in that respect.
Well, physically, yes. But what fascinates me about Spock as a character and what Nimoy did with him is, trying to walk that line. I mean, let's get into the four movies for a second. By the four movies, I mean 1, 2, 3, and 4, because... Let's just ignore 5 for a moment, and 6 doesn't really matter.
And 5 is the one with God in it, right?
Yes. So
okay.
Just brush that one aside, and 6 doesn't really matter too much. 6 is really a McCoy and Kirk story in a very many ways. So anyway, so in Star Trek 1, we see Spock trying to give up his human self. I mean, that's why he's been going through the Kolinar process on Vulcan all this time to basically purge himself of that, and it absolutely positively fails. He can't do it no matter how hard he tries. In 2, he's a fully rounded character who follows his logic to the conclusion of the good of the many outweighs the good of the one and sacrifices himself to do it. In Star Trek 3, we get to see him basically be reborn for all intents and purposes. And in Star Trek 4, we get to see him learn how to be Spock again. I mean, he starts off at the... Because I just recently watched it this week, so it's really fresh in my mind. And you've seen enough Sean, that it'd probably be fresh, probably be in your mind as well. That, yeah. I mean, at the beginning of that movie, he's been, as his mother said, he's been trained in the Vulcan way. So he is basically what he wanted to be in the first movie, just because of the way he got rebuilt. But that's not the way he needs to be. That's not the way he needs to be for himself or for the audience. And Star Trek IV is really a growth of him becoming Spock again. I mean, do you have a message for your mother? Tell her I feel fine. And that's just a great way to complete that arc over the four movies, with that little exchange with him and his father.
Mm. Yeah.
And to move in a slightly more toward a more kind of bright position, one of the things about Nimoy that stands out for me is his interesting kind of intervention into Lord of the Rings fandom with the Bilbo Baggins video.
Yes.
That is just so bizarre and funny and delightful and weird. And I think that's it's a great contrasting moment in Nimoy's kind of theatrical public life to kind of counterpoint with this kind of the somber severity of Spock, that you have this weird joyous moment, and that there's a callback to that in the car commercial that he and Zachary Quinto do together. So that there's very, very distinct points of lightness and bright in his career, in addition to the very studied, very serious of him as Spock or in other roles, or his very serious directorial work in The Body Project, or being very curious in Search of.
Yeah, I was singing that song earlier today. Because it's ridiculous, but at the same time, it's so charming. It's hard not to like it when you...
He's being a geek.
He is.
He's geeking out over Tolkien, and that's just wonderful.
Bilbo,
without
Bilbo Baggins, only 3 feet tall.
Yeah. Have either of you seen the 1999 TV movie version of Brave New World?
No.
I think I did, but I remember practically nothing about it.
I rewatched it a couple months ago because on another podcast, I was on there to talk Brave New World, and Jesse had suggested that I watch it so we could discuss it on the podcast, and I'd never seen it before, and I didn't realize that Leonard Nimoy was in it. He plays Mustafa Mond, but he plays Mustafa Mond in a completely different way than any way I've ever seen Brave New World ever done. He plays him as this 90s kind of hippie guru type. It's such a bizarre, weird performance. It's about as un-Spock as you can get. And I was charmed by it. I mean, he almost like this twinkle in his eye as he was dominating every scene he was in. He wasn't in a tremendous amount, but not almost an extended cameo in some ways. But I was really charmed by that. It really helped show his range much beyond Spock, because I hadn't seen him outside of Star Trek. I mean, I'd heard him in voices, and he's also done Atlantis, The Lost Empire, another small movie that no one's ever watched. That you gonna say something, Sean?
Oh, I mean, his. I think that's something that gets forgotten. Is he had an extraordinary range of roles, even just within science fiction. I mean, he did was it in Twilight Zone or in Outer Limits or both? Was he in some of those? He was in them, correct?
He was in them.
He was the scientist in them, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, no, he was the sergeant.
Oh, he was the sergeant. Okay, he was a scientist in a different one then.
He did a bunch of 50s and 60s bad movies. He was also on an episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. with William Shatner, as it so happens, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
This was before Star Trek.
He was in both Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits.
I thought so, okay. Yeah, but I mean, his range was extraordinary. I mean, he's sort of remembered as Spock, but of course he's done everything. Like, as Mike mentioned, he was the kind of villainous-ish kind of character on Fringe. I mean, I haven't seen enough of Fringe to know whether or not he's actually the villain, but I'm going to just say he's kind of villainy.
He was a mad scientist, but
there you
more
go.
Complicated than that.
A lot more complicated than villain. Mad scientist, pretty much evil. But, you know, hey, well, maybe not evil. Maybe just more like misunderstood.
Yeah, I think I would invite people to watch the show. If they're diehard Nimoy fans, I think the role in Fringe is interesting, especially in context with the John Noble character.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Gosh, I forgot John Noble's in that. I love him in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to watch more of that show.
He's really one of the main selling points about that show for me, along with Anna Torv's totally understated performance that a lot of people initially read as the actress being wooden, but it is the character. So that's a separate thing. But yeah, I commend Fringe onto you, dear listeners.
I mean, it would be very interesting, I think, if somebody actually went through and tried to hunt down everything that Nimoy had ever done on film and watch it all.
It's a long list.
It's a really long
judging
list.
Judging by Wikipedia, stretching all the way back to Queen for a Day as Chief, according to Wikipedia, in 1951.
Wow. I mean, it'd be a while just to even watch all the In Search Of's and the Star Trek episodes.
Yeah, I mean, there's what, like 80 episodes of classic Star Trek. There's the animated series. There's 6 movies.
And then he's in like a half dozen episodes of Next Generation as well.
Yep. He makes appearances there because Vulcans live forever, basically.
Simpsons.
Yeah, he's been on that.
Futurama.
True.
Columbo, a version of Marco Polo.
He was the villain in the episode of Columbo, wasn't he?
He
was Dr. Barry Mayfield, according to Wikipedia.
I think he was the villain in that one. I think he was the criminal.
Nice.
I think the Incompro crew were talking about that one, and I've probably seen that episode and don't even realize that I've seen Nimoy playing an evil doctor.
That is bizarre.
Yeah, my grandma was a big fan of Columbo.
He was in the iRobot episode of Outer Limits.
Okay.
That must have been a newer one, the new Outer Limits.
In 95, yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay, so not the 60s one. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, his career just spans, like, he's done all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, he's done stage productions, he's done all kinds of things. So
He did a voice in a Transformers movie.
Yeah, actually, so he was in both Outer Limits.
Oh,
yeah.
64 as Koenig/Judson Ellis in 2 different episodes, looks like.
So he stole Walter Koenig's name?
Different spelling.
That sounds...
K-O-N-I-G. But it very easily could have been a tip of the hat.
Oh, I don't know. No.
Well, 64. No, so... been before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe Walter Koenig used to be like Walter Smith. And changed it.
Many possibilities.
Now looking at this old war, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, he was in a good half dozen westerns over the years, including Wagon Train. So Wagon Train to the Stars, there's some continuity there.
Well, and that makes sense too, because the guy who played the doc.
DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, yeah. Who was actually known in westerns before he went on to Star Trek? Yeah. There's obviously the.
Were they in one together?
That would have been very interesting. I cannot recall. I know Nimoy mentions being in stuff with other Star Trek actors sometimes by happenstance, and him knowing other people who were on the show. I mean, in the early days of its creation, He never speaks unkindly about anybody, even when he's speaking unkindly about them, which I found really interesting. He's always sort of like very softly spoken in his writing when he talks about the shortcomings of others. Even William Shatner, who did direct a Star Trek movie to varying degrees of success.
Yeah. So, yep.
But in any case, I think that's probably a good time for us to start wrapping up. So we're just kind of talking about his work and his importance. And he'll obviously be very missed. I think science fiction lost a great one.
He lived long and prospered. But the ending of Star Trek II brought tears to my eyes watching it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was... And Star Trek III gave me such joy. Yeah. Although it's a kind of full stroke because we've lost the actor, but having the character reappear after losing the character was a little bit of a bump backwards.
But Spock's going to live on because we've got Zachary Quinto, who's currently in the role, in a version of the role.
An alternate universe version.
And I don't think Star Trek is going to go away, ever. It's always going to be part of the public consciousness in some way. Because
it'll be, like Doctor Who, will be rebooted for 1,500 years in the future, and there'll be more people playing Spock, I'm sure. But Nimoy is going to be the first and definitive one, always.
And I think it's very heartwarming to me to know that after struggling with the character, he came to accept the kind of the genre and the cultural influence that he had in inhabiting and kind of bringing that character to life, so that it was not something that troubled him later in life, but that kind of he welcomed the fandom that was directed at him with all of that attention and what came along with it.
And mobilized it to, in some cases, to positive effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. So thanks, Mike, and thanks, Paul, for coming at short notice to record this. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
It's an honor.
And, you know, guys, if you're listening and you'd like to maybe let us know what you think, David's got a post he's working on about his own particular take. Apparently it involves horror because it's David. So it will, of course, involve horror in some way, which would be very interesting. But of course, if you would like to leave a comment or something, let us know how you had a connection in any way, even if it's just it's a Star Trek, that's fine. You know, leave a comment. Links will be at the end. And that's it. Yeah. So there's no awkward ending on this one. So I'm just going to say goodbye. Bye.
Live long and prosper.
We are assembled here today to pay final respects to our honored dead. And yet it should be noted that in the midst of our sorrow, this death takes place in the shadow of new life, the sunrise of a new world, a world that our beloved comrade gave his life to protect and nourish. He did not feel this sacrifice a vain or empty one, and we will not debate his profound wisdom at these proceedings. Of my friend, I can only say this. Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels, his was the most human.